This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 11th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I am the host, Scott Feinberg, and so happy to be joined on this episode by a woman who I think is as funny as anyone in the world. She is the star of Inside Amy Schumer, which won the first and most recent Best Variety Sketch Emmy, and she also is the writer and star of this summer's hit film, Trainwreck, which could be a player in the coming awards season, perhaps not only at the Golden Globes, which recognizes musicals and comedies in their own categories, but maybe even at the Oscars, where comedic screenplays like hers have been recognized before. Before we go to the conversation with Amy, though, let's first recap what's happened since the last episode of the podcast was posted. Obviously, in the grand scheme of things, nothing matters next to what happened in Paris, which has been on all of our minds this week, and our thoughts and prayers are with everyone there. And that needs to be emphasized. Things here have continued, obviously, very somberly, including the Governor's Awards on Saturday night, which celebrated the careers of Spike Lee and Jenna Rollins, who received honorary Oscars, and in absentia, Debbie Reynolds, who received the Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award. That was a big night for the industry to celebrate these legends, and also for the people who are currently in the running for awards to come out and be seen by the many voters in the room. And so that was the big center of attention this past weekend, which came right on the heels of the AFI Fest, which opened with By the Sea, the Angelina Jolie Brad Pitt movie, was highlighted in the middle by Will Smith's vehicle Concussion, in which he played the doctor who took on the NFL over concussions, and then closed with The Big Short, the large ensemble movie adapted from Michael Lewis's best-selling book about the recent financial crisis. Now, By the Sea is not going to be a major player going forward in the awards race. It's just highly divisive and is not the kind of thing that the Academy goes for. Concussion looks like it's purely a Will Smith possibility. He's been nominated twice before for playing real people, and in this case does so with a Nigerian accent and a very moving story, so I think there's a good shot he'll be back in the running again. And then the wild card of the bunch is The Big Short, which is highly entertaining, very fun, very enjoyable, great cast, about an important subject matter, and yet large parts of it sail over the heads of many who see it. It's undermined perhaps by some of the things that make it entertaining, the humor in it with cameos from major celebrities. That makes it a fun watch. It maybe also makes it a little bit less of a serious player. It's also a movie that's going to be dissected left and right, and that may not help it when people really start to focus on the fact that the people at its center, its protagonists, are all people who essentially profited off of the misery of many fellow Americans. And obviously that doesn't affect whether or not it's a well-made or entertaining movie, but it is something that is a little distasteful when you got to kind of catch yourself when you're having too much fun with the movie. So we'll see how that one goes down with the Academy. It remains to be seen. I think people are still thinking about it. And finally, in major news of the past week, the Golden Globe categorizations have been solidified with the HFPA, the group that bestows them, deciding on a lot of close calls, or seemingly close calls. They've approved, for instance, The Martian as a comedy. I wasn't sure at all that that was going to happen, because while it does have some very funny lines, it also is quite dramatic. Joy, which not many of us have seen, was seen by them and labeled as a comedy, so that's informative. Trumbo, however, was submitted as a comedy but rejected by them as a comedy. And also rejected by them were the categorizations requested for Rooney Mara for the movie Carol and Alicia Vikander for the movie The Danish Girl. Both were being pushed, as they have been for the Oscars, in the supporting category, supporting actress category, And both of those requests were overturned by the HFPA, which felt that, as many others do, that those women have very substantial parts in the movies that they're a part of, co-leads, in fact, and so they will have to compete in the lead category, which is certainly more competitive. Coming back to comedies, though, I think we're going to find that very few people are going to have a safer bet at a nomination than our guest today, Amy Schumer, who has shot to stardom in the last year with the third season of her show and the recognition that it received, and then also Trainwreck, all of which have combined to make her perhaps the hottest comedian out there right now. She has fans across the spectrum, from Chris Rock, who directed her comedy special, to Jennifer Lawrence, who's her now close friend and collaborator on an upcoming screenplay, to Lily Tomlin, who says she's the best thing out there right now, and the list goes on and on and on. She is fascinating, one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. She is obviously very funny, and I'm so honored that she took a little time to come and chat with me for this podcast. So without further ado, let's go to Amy Schumer. Very excited that you came in to do this, and I know that you must be too, because from watching your show, I know there's nothing you like more than doing podcasts. So,
yeah, well, it's different. This is definitely a different kind of podcast, but you know, every comedian that I'm friends with has a podcast. And I'm just like, can we just have a conversation and not record it?
Right. Well, I appreciate it for this, and I guess just to recap for people who have lost track, it's been obviously a very big year for you, and let's just go through the Emmy for Inside Amy Schumer. First time the Variety Sketch Emmy's gone out. First produced screenplay and movie star vehicle, Trainwreck. Comedy special on HBO, big book deal, list goes on. So my question is, going from kind of somebody who was like almost like a cult phenomenon, people that thought they were in on the secret for the last few years about you, to somebody that everybody now knows about, does that put more or less pressure on you when you're doing your work? Do you feel like the stakes are higher or lower?
The stakes, I don't know. I think it's definitely changed. I would say the stakes are actually right where they've always been. I feel actually more of an ease because everything I've done, I'm like, well, I'm just going to do the best I can do. Mm-hmm. And then it's out of my hands. And I still feel that way. But these things that come up where you're so worried about them and, like any sort of big events that cause stress, whatever. I just now know if I do the work, then, you know, it's a opportunity plus preparation. You know, that's it. Right. So it's like, I know I'm going to work really hard. But things like stand-up, that's different because now every time I tweet, every time I try out a new joke, there could be like 5 think pieces on it, and people, well, what did this mean? And but right. Wait, you said this back in. Comedians are treated like politicians now, and it's difficult, but it's something, you know, if you're like, I just really want to, I'm committed to being authentic, mm-hmm. and that's the only way I know how to be. So, you know. But I would say same stakes. But larger numbers.
And is this kind of what the dream always looked like, or what was the kind of, as you look back, what was the ultimate place this could end up?
I think I pictured myself as Georgette the poodle in All Dogs Go to Heaven. Like, I seriously did not ever have a dream. I just always loved performing, but I didn't see myself as a movie star or a comedian. I did plays my whole life, and I just wanted to make a living performing and entertaining in mm-hmm. some way. And so, yeah, there was and has never been a dream.
When did you first realize that you were funny?
When I was 5. I was doing Sound of Music. I was playing Gretel. And I think I thought I was funny around the house, and I would, you know, my parents would just tell me different faces to make, and but I was on stage playing Gretel, and the audience, every time I would say anything, would laugh. And it was really hurting my feelings, and I asked the director, you know, why do they laugh? She said, because they love you. It's good when people laugh. It means you made them happy. And I really remember that being explained to me and understanding that it was like a gift.
And as you grew up, were there, and you kind of had a better sense of what was out there, what were there particular comedians that meant a lot to you? Who were the ones that influenced you?
It was less stand-ups that when I was younger, mm-hmm. than it was more actresses. It was, I loved Lily Tomlin and Goldie Hawn and Carol Burnett. I loved Gilda Radner on SNL. And then when I got into stand-up, you know, just becoming aware of it, I really liked Whoopi Goldberg. And then, you know, just like Rita Rudner, Judy Gold.
Right.
And yeah, but you know, I think my stand-up is influenced by probably every comedian I've ever seen.
Right, right. It seems like for most comedians, I don't know if most is fair, but a lot of comedians, their humor, their desire to be funny, whatever it is, comes out of this kind of either something dark. There was a Dickensian childhood or terrible mm-hmm. parents or whatever it
right.
was. I don't get the sense that that was the case with you, but is it? I mean, where do you think this just sort of desire to make other people laugh, aside from, you know, you said like you, it was a fun to get the feedback or whatever,
yeah.
but what most people don't then make it their career. So what do you think made you take that next step?
Well, thank you for thinking that. But no, I had a very tough childhood, actually. And you can read about it in my book.
All right.
But I would say it's just the perfect storm of having some tragedy as a kid. And, you know, all kids have obstacles, but I really had the deck stacked against me. And being naturally funny, just having those instincts and that timing. And I think anyone can get better at stand-up. I think even if you're really a bad comic, you can go on the road and get better, but I don't think you can ever have that thing that just makes people just see you and like you right away. I think that's, Lorne Michaels was talking to me about that, but I was pretty drunk. But yeah, just there's some people, they just walk out on camera and people just love them.
Yes, there. Well, I'm not sure that you kind of referenced this a moment ago, but I'm not sure that people realize that prior to becoming well known for comedy, you were really on the acting track, and that you, just to, you know, recap, this was what your college degree was in. I read you studied Meisner, that you worked in movies and TV before we came to know you as a comic. So can you just talk about that? Because I think it's kind of like very overlooked.
Sure. It was, yeah, you know, doing plays my whole life, and then studied theater, did all the plays in college, and then did a 2-year Meisner program. I studied with William Esper in New York and then continued into his master class. And it was, yeah, I'm a trained ass actress. and I would, you know, get booked in, I think, all the comedies that shot in New York I got to do an episode of at some point. But then I would be cast in something, and then maybe one of the guys on the crew would say, oh, she's a comic. Like, they'd heard me on Stern or Opie and Anthony or something. And people would be like, oh, I heard you're a comic. And so it was like, it was kind of fun. It was nice to feel like I was living this double life. I was doing this play where I was playing a mom accused of beating her kids, and also I was running to open for Jim Norton at Caroline's Comedy Club. So I did feel like I was living this double life, and it was kind of fun not having one overlap with the other.
And is there still a desire to do dramatic acting, or is it mainly you're going to focus on the comedy?
Both. Yeah. I love both. I love that, and I love performers like that. I loved how Richard Pryor could have you crying, laughing, and then just have you crying
right.
a second later. I think that a lot of comics are pretty good actors just because there is that pain
yeah.
behind all the jokes. But yeah, I want to definitely do both.
Is it true that one of the roles you went out for was The Wrestler? I had heard that was one of those movies.
Yeah. I went in with Darren Aronofsky and his producer, Scott Franklin. And that was, it was, I was on the Last Comic Standing tour. And it was like I had to fly, I think, from Detroit to New York, audition, and then fly and meet them in Milwaukee or something. and it was just like such a hellish day. But it was, yeah, it was really, I felt really good about my audition with him. And then, you know, I got really good feedback on that. And then, like, an interview I did a couple years ago, they were, like, fact-checking, and they're like, yeah, Darren said that you did not audition. And I was like, what? I was like, no, call him back. Yeah, right. And like, I was like, no. But that lets you know, you think you were real close to getting a role, and you were, like, not even in the top 10.
Well, stand-up, though, was something that, like, came quickly to you, or was it something that took a lot of work?
Stand-up doesn't come quickly to anyone. Okay. You can, I was like, you know, I was on Last Comic, and it was like, you would have to have kind of a 30 to 90 second soundbite of something funny, and that's what I had at the time. I probably had altogether 12 minutes of stand-up, but that's kind of fine, and that can get you through. If anything, it would be impossible for me to do that now, because I'm so used to doing a long sets. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when you start out, no one's good. You're just bad. You have to be, like, really delusional to think. I don't know. I think people have to be somewhat mentally ill to do stand-up. It's such a because you're not good for, like, 10 years.
And then you just
I was good enough. Like, you know, you can get good enough to make money from it. But to be good, I'm not. I'm proud of what I'm doing now, but I think that I'm nowhere near where I hope to get.
Well, that's exciting. How did sex become such a big focal point of your comedy, whether it's the stand-up or the sketch show or the movie or just everything?
Yeah, I don't know. I've always been interested in sex. I'm not a I'm not someone who's had a lot of crazy sex, and I'm not a freak, and I mean, still, I've never had anal sex. No one's ever come on my face, like, nothing crazy, but I've always been interested in it. I remember I would, like, steal my mom's Red Book magazine and, like, read those articles and, like, share them with my friends and get in trouble. I just thought it was interesting. I want to hear about it, and it's this secret thing that I think people, once they open up about it, it's really liberating, and it's also that so much tragedy attached to it, just so many awful experiences. Like, if it's, you know, whether you're in a new relationship or it's just a one-night stand, like, something is probably going to go very wrong. But I've only had one one-night stand. And so I think just talking about it has been enough for people to be like, oh, she's, like, very sexual. But it's just interested in me, and I think there's just so much room for comedy.
Do you think that, well, I guess one of the things that you've done that's interesting is you've always, certainly with the show and with the movie, you call your character Amy.
Yeah.
So maybe does that perhaps reinforce the idea that you're playing yourself, or is that, you know, the question I think you're saying you're not, in maybe in that sense, are, in other senses, are you?
Well, there's a lot of me in those roles, but if you know, even my character in Trainwreck, she was sleeping with a lot of men, and I would say that that's a phase that I went through when I was a sophomore in college, like end of freshman year, sophomore year of college. I was in a lot of pain, and I definitely, my numbers went up, and so it's something I can relate to and sympathize with, and so I really wanted to tell a story of that girl who you would usually just look at and be like, oh, she's a drunk, she's a slut, and say, well, let's look at what's going on with her. And then my character on the TV show, you know, sometimes I'm the everyman, I'm the eyes and ears of the people, and then sometimes I'm a monster and a narcissist and a victim and racist. It's like, you know, it's so, I think, I don't know, we never really made a big decision to call me Amy on the show or in the movie, but then I was just like, let's just do it.
Yeah. So chronologically, the it seems like you've described your big break as the episode that you did for Live at Gotham on Comedy Central. Is that, you still feel that way?
Well, that was my first time doing stand-up on television, and that just felt the best.
Yeah,
I definitely didn't get, you know, noticed out of that.
That would have been Last Comic Standing. Was where you really got it.
Yeah, Last Comic was prime time. You know, goes from, I think, you know, maybe 100,000 people saw my set on Comedy Central, and then 9 million people were watching Last Comic Standing. Yeah. So, but you know, it's like a bunch of false starts, and then I headlined for a year out of placing fourth on that, and then went back and opened for people and learned how to do stand-up.
And was the Charlie Sheen roast, did that give a bounce as well? Is that what made Comedy Central itself say, let's see what her idea is about, you know, for the show?
I think so. Chronologically, I don't know what the order was. I think I did the roast and then filmed my hour special. And we already knew I was going to do an hour, and we already knew I was going to do a pilot. But the pilot definitely got picked up after the night my special filmed.
Really?
They were like, we're going to pick up your show. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So the you've said of the show that it's the show, this TV show is my dream. The show is everything I have in me. I like to create stuff. I like to express myself through jokes. Do you still get as much enjoyment three seasons into it as you did at first? I mean, do you grow into it? Does it get easier for you?
Well, we're writing the fourth season right now. We're in the offices, and it's so fun. It's even more fun now because the first season, we're like, what are we doing? And this is, and then we were really proud of the first season. And I'm like, well, I've got nothing left to say. I can't do a second season. And then the third season, it feels we kind of hit our stride and figured out what we are. And now it's really fun. And it's, you know, there's a couple new faces, but it's the same people for 4 years now. And the crew I've worked with even longer than that, because they were on the Adult Swim show Delocated, John Glazer's show. They were all together there, and I worked with them there. And so it's just a great feel. And in terms of the content and writing it and producing it, it's still so exciting. It's still expressing the things that are just at the forefront of our minds
right
now. Just something, and it's just a different kind of vehicle. Like, some people will tweet at me or that whatever, and they'll be like, I liked Trainwreck, but I don't like her stand-up, or I like the TV show better than her stand-up. You know, it's like,
they have to share that.
Yeah,
with
I'm like, thank you so much for your feedback. But it's all these, you know, it's its own thing, and it's, I can express things there I can't in my stand-up, and you can't in a movie.
Are you pretty much given free rein by the network, or how does that work? Do they have to vet things closely? Or
the truth is, they are. We've gained their trust. That, you know, we call and we say, hey, I'd like to do a full episode where we recreate 12 Angry Men, and I'm only in it for 30 seconds.
And it's black and white.
Yeah, and it's black and white. And they were like, let's do it. And they were like, well, you need to be on it more. And I was like, yeah. We just didn't. But they've been awesome the whole time.
And who's your core collaborators on that? Who are the key people?
Jesse Klein is the head writer. Yeah. Dan Powell is the EP, and he writes as well. And then the writers who've been there from the very beginning are Kurt Metzger, Kyle Dunnigan, and then the last 3 years, it's been Christine Nangle, Tammy Sager, my sister, Kim Caramelli, is a huge asset. This season, she has been on fire. We keep joking that we need to call it Inside Kim. And our writer's assistant, Grace Edwards, is a huge part of it. And then John Glazer.
Tig
will only wrote for one season.
Only one season, okay.
Yeah. Who else? Christine Nangle is amazing. I know I'm forgetting. Oh, Mike Lawrence is writing this year.
Sure. So from your perspective, the writing versus the performing, what do you get more pleasure out of?
Writing.
Really?
Yeah. It's so fun. That's kind of the most fun. I'm kind of all about the work that happens before the thing. I don't know. Yeah, writing is the most fun. I love it. I still really enjoy doing stand-up. But the TV show, I really enjoy being behind the camera. I enjoy directing. I directed the 12 Angry Men episode, and I don't know. I really love writing.
Has there been one of these sketches that's been the toughest to sell? I mean, I've heard that sell in the sense of like getting everybody on board. I'd heard that Last Fuckable Day was not a very easy one.
That was the hardest. We were trying to make that for 3 years. We kept rewriting it, and that is a labor of love. That is Jesse Klein's baby. I'm very proud for my work on that scene, but right. Jesse and I were both fighting for that scene for 3 years. Right. That was the hardest to get made,
and that may have birthed more think pieces than any of them.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Now, coming back to the writing for a second, the rumor was, and I don't know, maybe it's confirmed, maybe it's rebutted, but that you had been asked to do the Daily Show after Jon Stewart left. Was that? If that's the case, was there was a consideration the format? Because it's obviously would be a very different thing than what you've done. Or is it just the idea that every day you have? It's hard enough to do however regularly you guys are churning out the show. But what were the considerations there?
Well, the Daily Show I love, And I think Trevor Noah is doing such an amazing job. And when it was brought up to me as a possibility, I just was so moved that they thought I could handle that. Just, you know, because it is a little bit of a family at Comedy Central. So I felt like my parents were saying, like, we want you to take – we're giving you our nicest car.
Right.
And I just was so – just flattered and just really thought about it and just thought, you know, I really considered it. And it was a little bit just knowing that I would be in the building for like 5 years and right. do the show. And it was kind of just what the process would be. And I'm more excited about not knowing the paths I'm going to go down.
Sure. So,
as I'm homeless in a year, just like outside your office with a tin can.
How did you and Judd Apatow first connect, and you know, why do you think it clicked for so long? I think he's been associated with this with bromances. That was his thing,
mm-hmm.
but obviously it's a lot more than that. So, how did that happen?
Well, first, I think Judd gets this rap of like bromances, and people are like, why doesn't he write more for like? He's a guy. Yes. You write what you know. I think it's such a strange criticism, and I think that he's had a lot of funny women in his movies always. And the lead in Freaks and Geeks was a chick. It's just I don't know. It's a strange criticism, but Judd and I. He heard me on Stern, and he wanted to just have a general meeting. He meets with lots of comics. He likes to just keep himself up on who's coming up. And we had a good meeting. We just hung out. He's a comic. We just kind of bullshit and gossiped. And he was sound mixing This Is 40, and I was just blown away that I got to meet him.
Right.
It was the biggest deal in the world to me. Not like now when I'm like super famous and important and he can't even get me on the phone.
Right.
No, but so, and he was like, if you ever have an idea for a movie, just, you know, and I was like, well, I do have an idea. And I kind of pitched him this idea and he said, oh, well, you should write it. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, should I buy a book on how to write movies? And he's like, yeah, I got this book, my teacher at NYU. And then, I was reading this book and sending him scenes, and he's just really encouraging me. And that first movie went away, and I don't know, maybe it'll wind up somewhere, but we kind of threw it all out. I then knew I could write a movie, that I could physically do it, and that was just good for my confidence. Yeah. And then, like a year later, we started talking about what was going to be Trainwreck, and I just kept thinking that why is he bluffing? This is so weird. And I just worked so hard, and I was not bluffing. I was like, if this doesn't happen, it's not going to be because I dropped the ball in any way. He would want a rewrite, and I would send it to him in a week or less.
That's what he was saying. I saw an interview where he was talking about that, and he was amazed that the turnaround and the ability to implement notes and whatever. And I just have to ask a few maybe seemingly random questions,
okay.
but about your writing. So
sure.
Where do you write?
I write in bed.
Do you really?
Yeah, I sit up in bed and I write, and I have like lots of liquids next to me, just coffee and water and juice, and I just sit there like a woman in hospice and just kind of type for hours and hours.
And so, okay, that, I guess, answers the next question, which is, what do you write on? It's not like a collection of a million napkins
no,
or something.
It's a Mac.
Mac?
Yeah.
And do you like?
It's a filthy Mac. I'm so embarrassed by how dirty my computer is. It's disgusting.
Do you like interruptions, or do you need complete focus?
No, I mean, I was doing rewrites while I was filming my TV show and while I was editing and writing it. So it would be like every second of my life was accounted for. It would be like, okay, I can write from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Then I need to go to bed, which really means I'm going to write for 45 minutes because I'll procrastinate. I'll find anything else I'll be like, oh, what would the couch look like over there? Like anything. So it's, but still, if you do that,
right,
that 45 minutes adds up. So I'll get to a certain point. If I'm like in the groove of things, I don't want to be, and you know, if somebody calls, right, I'll say, can I call you back?
Right.
But I like to, you know, send a scene to my sister or Kevin Kane, who's my partner and everything. And I'm like, is this funny? Do you think I can do this? And just, I need encouragement.
Well, I heard about that there was a theater collective that you're involved with. Can you talk about? I guess they've been consulted on a lot of this.
Oh yeah, the collective we formed. Oh my gosh, it's almost 10 years ago now.
Wow.
We seven of us study together at the William Esper Studio, and we wanted to model ourselves after the group theater, and we're still going strong. And every season of the TV show, I bring scenes in, we put them up on their feet there, we work them out. We have rehearsals. We rehearse the show like it's a play. And same with Trainwreck. We did a lot of rehearsals there. And every Monday night, we meet about 7 to 10 at a theater. And different writers come and actors. And you work on stuff you're working on. And we also produce original productions. And been a huge...
That's great.
Help.
Again, I don't know. I only learned that in the course of prepping for this. I had no idea. So I think that was...
Yeah, I'm a secret theater nerd. I'm not complete. Yeah.
Well, so as far as this HBO special just now, you worked with Chris Rock, who's your director on it.
Yeah.
How did that come about? And also, what was the experience like? And last part of this, going back to the rumor mill, but we heard that you may have been asked to do the Oscars with him. Is that any validity to that?
I can't wait to see him host the Oscars.
Yes.
So anyway, Chris and I were just, you know, friendly, knew each other from around the Comedy Cellar, and I couldn't be a bigger fan. He's probably the greatest living comedian. And then, you know, just you get better at stand-up. And these comedians, like people like him and Louis and Seinfeld, like they want other people to come and be able to play in their playpen. But it's rare. And I'm not saying that I'm there yet, but they could see the potential in me. And so Chris, we did a fundraiser for autism together. And after my set, he said, let me know when you're working on something. And again, I jump on opportunity. I said, well, actually, I'm preparing for an hour special right now. Wow. He said, okay, I'll come watch your set this week and give you notes. So he came. I did an hour at a club, and he gave me great notes. And then two more times he came, and I said, you want to direct it? And it's just timing. I just caught him at a good time. I just said, would you direct the special? And he said, it could happen, you know, and just he thought about it. And then he called me, I think a couple days later, and he was like, I'll do it. And I was jumping up and down in my hotel room. I was so excited. And, you know, so most people direct comedy specials and you don't even see them till the day. You could realistically shoot a stand-up special and never meet the director. But Chris was on the road with me. We were running around doing all the clubs in New York together. He's giving me notes, changing my order, expanding. He just made it. That was like my make-a-wish. That was the that was my dream come true, to have Chris Rock helping me with my stand-up and my special. And it was, and you know, now we're really good friends. And it was such a beautiful, cool experience. I feel really, really grateful I got to have that.
That's awesome. Well, last last three things if I can, really quickly. You kind of helped to break the internet with this thing with Miss Lawrence, and I want to ask you what exactly how that one started as well, and the relationship, and then also this idea that this revelation that you guys are working together. Can you say anything about what that's about?
How do we break the internet?
I think people went crazy. This is like
about the jet ski, just you, like us being friends.
Yeah, the very fact that you know each other and you're hanging out.
Man, like I feel that excited about it. So it's cool that the internet felt the same.
Right.
The truth is, I am such a fan of hers, and my sister and I are crazy Hunger Games fans. I go right to the young adult section in bookstores. And we just loved her, like everyone else. You know, you see this girl and you see her in interviews and you just think she just seems like the coolest girl. I wish I was friends with her. And she saw Trainwreck and it sounds like she kind of felt the same way. And so, and then she emailed me and, we were emailing back and forth a little bit. And she was like, I want you to write a movie for us to do together. And so I went straight from that email to just writing a movie for us to get. I sent her like six scenes for us, six or seven scenes, and was like, here's what I'm thinking, and she was like, oh shit, okay. And we became friends, you know, be like, hey, come hang out, we're going on this thing, and we would meet up and we became friends. We just really connected, because the truth is, I don't want to be friends with famous people, like, you know, not especially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we don't need each other in terms of work, but it does feel like we need each other in terms of our friendship. Like, there are just some things I feel like we really understand about each other. And so I believe people come into each other's lives when they need them. And Jen and I just kind of like clung to each other. Like, this is happening for a reason. And so the two of us and my sister have been writing this script together. And
is it like a buddy comedy, or what's the genre? Obviously I'm assuming comedy.
It's funny for sure.
Yeah.
I would say it's a comedy, but in the way the Trainwreck had some heaviness to it, this movie definitely has a lot of truth and a lot of heaviness. But it is hilarious. I feel comfortable saying that. And it's not connected to any studio or a director or anything right now. It's still just the three of us girls and our friends and, you know, people in the industry who've read it to just give us notes. But it's exciting.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So now, again, coming back to where we were at the beginning, where just as things have changed, and particularly, I guess, in the last year, maybe, would you say, where people are now looking at dissecting everything you do, everything you say with, you know, you're one of Time's 100 most influential people, things like that. So when something like the tragedy that happened at the screening of Trainwreck with the gun violence happens, and you came out in a non-comedic way, obviously, with your cousin and talked about that. When somebody brings up, you know, the PC police come after you for something in your past and you have to engage on that, are you, how do you feel when you have to, you know, now turn off the humor sometimes and engage on the actual issues that are at the root of the humor?
Well, I think it's part of just evolving as an adult that these things, you know, when you're a young kid, you don't care who you're voting for. Like, you just think everything's gonna always be fine and I'm fine. And then you realize, oh no, and we need to actually take action if we want any sort of change and speak up. And so I just, you know, when that happened in Lafayette, the two girls, Jillian Johnson and Macy Bro, that they died and they really didn't have to. And the guy, the shooter, it was just, you know, all these shootings are so senseless. And the fact that there have been over 100 shootings since July. And with what happened in Paris and everything, it's just, I'm someone who right now is in a position to be heard. And I know when I would see an actor or a comic kind of speak up about politics, you're kind of like, stay in your lane. And I totally understand that. But I feel a real drive and responsibility to try and get stricter checks on guns. And what my cousin and I are lobbying for is if you've been convicted of domestic violence or if you are severely mentally ill, that you not be able to get a gun. And that seems pretty logical to me. But, you know, there are a lot of people out there who that really freaks them out and upset.
And you just wonder if you can reach them. Yesterday, some of them are responding to what happened in Paris saying if only they had guns.
They had just, more guns. Right. Everyone in their shit. Yeah. It's definitely going to show up on my TV show this season. And it is scary. But, you know, I feel strongly about it, and I think just you evolve as an adult, hopefully, and you say, oh, these other things are becoming really apparent to me and really important, and I want to do what I can.
But you've taken some flack for speaking out about it?
Well, yeah, anybody who says that they want stricter gun checks is going to be met with a sea of rage. Mm-hmm. That's just how it goes. But and in terms of the, you know, just any sort of flack I've gotten, it's a lot. It's really a lot to adjust to, having every word, every outfit you wear be analyzed. And I have just, yeah, committed to myself to just be as authentic as I can be, because the stand-up's so important to me. I don't want to become this safe watching everything I say, because then I'm just dead in the water. So right. I'm going to do a better job. The mistakes I've made have been, it's a rookie mistake to respond. But I've felt this kind of connection with people and want to respond. And I want to be honest and open and say, oh, well, this is what happened. But then if you respond, it becomes,
no, it's so interesting because
it becomes national news. And so it forces you into isolation and to not comment. So there's just no other way. So I'm unfortunately being, really advised to be quiet.
Mm-hmm. Well, the last question is that I guess because of the screen persona, certainly on the show and I guess maybe in the movie as well, people, I think, feel like they can probably say anything to you. You're a instant buddy. And I just wonder, what's that aspect of it like? And also, you know, part B, because you're getting a lot of feedback, what's been the most meaningful to you from all of this, particularly in the last year as things have taken off?
I would say most of the people who approach me are smart, and they can tell what's a character and what's not. Not all of them. A lot of girls come up to me, and they're just like, oh, my God, like, I'm you, you know? And I'm like, no, like, I'm doing a parody of you
right.
in that scene. But most, for the most part, you know, once in a blue, someone will come up to me and say something really ugly, thinking it's funny. And it breaks my heart, and I get over it quicker and quicker. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of comes with the territory. I'm trying to be good with my boundaries. It's been helpful seeing, because I have a couple friends who have been famous for a while, to see how they handle it. And because at a certain point, you can't, if I took a picture with everyone who asked, I would not have a job.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, like it's just. And people get really upset, and they feel like they know you, and they're like, why wouldn't you just... And I'm like, I'm in a rush, or my friend just told me bad news, and I'm trying to be here for... And what was the second part?
What's been the most meaningful feedback?
Oh, the most meaningful feedback. There's been so much. Well, definitely from some of my heroes, just having Gloria Steinem say that she not only loved Trainwreck, but that she saw it with an ease, that she wasn't worried about being protected as a woman, that I would be doing something that would make her feel embarrassed or hurt or wronged. That was huge. And a lot of young girls, like, when the people who I pass on the street And it's not just young girls. I don't know why I said that. But I really like the idea of encouraging young women so that they don't waste any time with not being empowered or not liking themselves. And but it's just, it's really women in general. Like, guys have been great, and I feel lucky. 50% of my TV show, it's 60% are watched by men, and Trainwreck, it was seen by a lot of men, but and my stand-up is 50-50. But really? The women on the street, they look at me, and they smile at me, and say things like, keep going, and thank you, and I just feel so much support and love out there. And so I would say it's just, just those women.
Terrific. Well, yeah. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Love this stuff.
Awesome.